Welcome to the 10th edition of WFAE Talks, our weekly podcast in which a few of us in WFAE's newsroom talk about some of the stories in the news and how we and other media outlets cover them. We also delve into general office banter every now and then. Reporters Lisa Miller and Ben Bradford join me now. Been looking at your brackets?
Yeah, NCAA. I have my bracket right in front of me, actually.
Do you really?
I was not very active in the last sports talk, so
I didn't even realize.
So you're ready for this one?
I'm ready.
Okay. well, tell us what's interesting about your bracket.
Well, I would like to say that I got both the Dayton victory and the Harvard victories right, as well as the North Dakota State victory.
Wow, that's pretty good.
But you're not doing too well overall, though. You were kind of near the bottom when I looked at standings last night. This is in
our little office bracket, and we don't really know what's at stake at the moment.
Yeah, I was at the bottom.
Yeah. So you've got the upsets.
I got the upsets, and that's about all I got.
Nice. So I have a real problem with mine, which is that I'm not a big college basketball guy. I don't watch a ton of it, but I was feeling pretty strong about my bracket. I, you know, did my research and so forth. But I made a sloppy error and dragged American, which was a 15th seed, all the way up to – I was trying to drag Wisconsin, and instead I dragged American up to the Elite Eight in our bracket. And so that's a huge problem for me, although one of our when I looked at it,
I had them going today, at least winning the first match.
Match?
Yeah, nice.
It's a game.
Yeah, it's a game. That was pretty embarrassing. So I'm already pretty far in the hole because of that. Otherwise, picks have been pretty good. But one of our Megan Batchelor, who's our office manager. She apparently asked one of our other coworkers in the bracket. She says, "Does Ben know that he's not just putting America up there? That American is a college?"
Well, that's a fair question.
Right. So I think I'm just going to stick with that. I'm the most patriotic.
Okay. You could appeal to the commissioner, Kevin Kniestad.
I don't think I can do that.
For mercy.
No, I think this sort of incompetence requires punishment.
Well, I have a problem right now with our whole news or WFAE pool, NCAA pool, because what's the prize?
That's a big question.
Kevin didn't ask. He put this together, didn't ask anyone to pitch in any money or anything. I mean, is lunch at stake here or anything? There needs to be some kind of prize.
Right. I'll pitch in $1.
For someone's lunch?
Well, I've got this American problem now, so I'm not willing to pitch in anything, but I'd be willing to shave the winner's head.
Okay. Well, we still need to take this up with Kevin. He needs to come to a decision. All right. Well, there's more important things to discuss, too, but I don't know if they're as interesting as the NCAA
as our little office bracket, because that's what everybody wants to hear people talk about. Gosh. Is your office bracket. No, go ahead. All right,
Did you watch NC State, by the way? You didn't watch. You're not big. It's just pitiful how they gave that game away. Just disgusting.
What are we talking about today, Greg? What are we talking about?
Okay. Well, Duke Energy. You're going to be talking about Duke Energy.
Yeah.
Duke Energy is in more trouble over one of its coal ash ponds. CPCC drops out of the federal loan program and charter school secrecy. So first up, Ben,
yeah.
Duke Energy, it's in more trouble over it's been polluting the Cape River basin illegally and says it was allowed to do this. So it's several thousand gallons of stormwater.
Here's what happened. An environmental group called the Waterkeeper Alliance, they sent out a notice. They sent out links to some photos that they'd taken. They actually did a flyover. They hired a helicopter or an airplane, and probably a helicopter, and went over this facility and took pictures of it. And there are a few reasons to that, and we'll get to those. But while they were doing it, they saw something kind of interesting, which is they saw this pump running from one of the coal ash ponds, right? So these are these big pits where they store the leftovers from burning coal, and they store them in water, and that way the ash doesn't fly away. You don't breathe it in. But the ash is toxic, contains heavy metals like arsenic and chromium and lead and, you know, all those kind of things. And so they saw the water from the ponds being pumped into this tributary that then feeds into the Cape Fear River.
Cape Fear River.
And this is a tributary that runs into the Cape Fear River. And they find this thing pumping into the Cape Fear River. And they sent us these photos. And the state says, hey, we're looking at it. And the state, meanwhile, has been doing its own investigation since the Dan River spill. So remember, at the beginning of last month, you had one of these ash ponds fail. Mm-hmm. And at least 30,000 tons of ash, along with 27 million gallons of water, and that number 27 million is important in a second here, fell into the Dan River. Now they see that this other pond is that they're pumping the water mm-hmm. into this tributary. So state regulators, meanwhile, have been doing investigations since the Dan River spill of all these other ash ponds around the plant. And they, this week, released their own kind of report on this, basically agreeing with the environmental groups, saying, yeah, that's right. And not only is it have they been pumping water out, it's been happening since September from these different ponds, and it was 61 million gallons of water. So that's more than double the amount that of water, although without, you know, the hard mm-hmm. ash itself going in.
No, I assume there's some coal ash residue. It's not coal ash,
that's right.
It's mainly...
That's right. So, and right now the state says it's doing testing of the surface water of the river and the tributary and so forth. And but drinking water downstream so far hasn't shown up any problems.
Why does Duke do this? Why does Duke think this is okay?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what Duke says is that what Duke told the state is that they were doing routine maintenance. They needed the water level to be a little bit lower so they could work on some pipes in the pond, and so it was routine maintenance. And the state says, well, hey, listen, this is so much water. This is not routine maintenance. This goes far beyond routine maintenance. Duke is still sticking by kind of the routine maintenance story. They say they've got the permits. The state has cited them. They've given them what's called a notice of violation, which means that they could fine Duke for it. And Duke has 30 days to respond. So once they do respond, we'll get maybe a better idea of why they think of how they think they can justify putting this much water into this tributary.
This is 60 some million gallons of unfiltered dirty water, basically.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you got to understand, I mean, part of the whole issue of coal ash, if you back up, right, you back up, you know, before the Dan River spill, before this newest incident. Coal ash, the state is suing Duke and after being pressured by environmental groups to over coal ash in general, because all of these ash ponds both have seepages. They're earthen ponds, which means that they seep into groundwater and then flow into water. So this water flows in certain amounts, flows into our groundwater, into our waterways and so forth. And then there are also places where they're designed to flow into our waterways.
So are they – is Duke basically then calling this seepage something that's
saying,
authorized because
yes.
it's
– They're saying that they're allowed to do it. They have basically in cases of routine maintenance, they're allowed to put water. They have to keep measuring the water quality, and if that shows up fine, they're allowed to put more of this into the river. And that's a good point because – there's the larger kind of context to this issue that I don't think we always understand is that a lot of this stuff is allowed to go into our rivers and into our water, right? I mean, just mm-hmm. by the way these things are designed, all of the permits at every ash pond, which are monitored by the state, have I mean, just the way that they're built, the way that they're structured, Duke is allowed to I mean, that's the way these things are designed, is for some of the water to go into nearby waterways and go into groundwater and so forth. And there's a lot more scrutiny now than there used to be. And now those practices are really being looked at. The environmental groups would tell you that, you know, it's well past time for that. That's kind of their argument. Mm-hmm. But it's been happening for a long time.
And the state wasn't impressed with Duke's response.
The state was not.
Duke's excuse.
I talked to them yesterday, and they were... you know, they're always careful about what they're going to say, but they were pretty heated. First of all, they'd done an inspection of the Cape Fear plant. They'd had an inspector out in December, And so, you know, of course, the question comes up, well, why didn't they see this? And apparently what the state says is that their regulator went out there, checked out this plant, saw this disconnected pump over there, said, hey, what's that all about? And Duke said, well, it's just kind of routine maintenance. And they said, well, that should have just come up right in conversation, that this had been an ongoing activity. And the fact that they didn't do that, they were upset, I would say, that Duke hadn't disclosed that at that time. Of course, I think that also raises questions about the process of these kinds of visits, right?
A lot of trust involved.
That's exactly right. I mean, you're looking for a lot of self-reporting there. And so, you know, the whole Duke's rationale and the state backs this up is that there was a phone call in August saying, hey, we're going to do some routine maintenance. And then, you know, in December, they come out and say, hey, we're going to come visit and look at the thing. Duke disconnects the pump. Which Diener says it would, which the state says it would have frowned upon, seeing they disconnect it, don't pump that day, and then start doing it again the next week.
And routine maintenance, 60 million gallons of
right.
this
right.
wastewater going into the
right.
Cape Fear
so River Basin. Yeah, so it's a big deal for a variety of reasons, and it plays into this kind of larger narratives of environmental groups saying that. That state regulators have been lax.
Do you have any feel for whether this routine maintenance explanation would have flown a year ago when there wasn't this intense scrutiny?
I think that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. I think that people wouldn't be flying over taking pictures of this thing a year ago, I don't think, without the Dan River spill. And certainly the state regulators wouldn't have been doing these week-long kind of all-hands-on-deck inspections without the Dan River spill. They did it specifically as a reaction to the Dan River spill.
There's so many facets to this, a whole case and incident that we were talking in the newsroom earlier that, Ben, I think you need to just do sort of something that wraps it all up and reminds us, because, you know, one of the things, too, we've been hearing is there's a leak here, or there's a corroded pipe here.
If not more than that.
What, you
every
know,
week,
what,
it's just there's
what's
something
going
else.
On?
The other thing that we haven't mentioned is that 4 hours after the state said, hey, we're going to cite Duke, we're issuing them this notice of violation for pumping all this water, is then the state sent out another release saying, oh, now we're hearing that there is a crack in one of the dams at Cape Fear, at the same plant where all the pumping was happening. Now there's a crack in one of the dams, and that's a big deal, because they say there's no water coming out, at least in the initial report, there was no water coming out, and the dam wasn't in imminent danger of failure, which I'm sure is really comforting.
Is that because all the water was being pumped out?
Well, the water being pumped out would not affect it. I think that there is probably some questions. They said that Duke Energy had just reported that a crack had just formed.
Okay.
And the crack was 60 feet. It was horizontal. It's a horizontal crack. And you can see, if you go on our website and look at the story, there's a picture of it we have on there. But it's a horizontal crack in this earthen dam that's about 60 feet across and then about 6 inches wide at its widest points. But, I mean, I think there is some question about, you know, as you relieve, you know, water causes pressure on dams. So if you relieve, you can relieve that pressure by pumping out water. Mm-hmm. So that raises a question.
Some of this will be part of an upcoming public conversations we're going to be discussing in our newsroom meeting next week.
That's but, right. That should be exciting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the goals of it, is to look a little bit more at, okay, hey, so what actually goes into the water?
Right. Well, segue, next topic. CPCC drops out of a federal loan program. You had that story this week, Lisa. And so students at Central Piedmont Community College will not have access to federal loans through the college.
Exactly, which means they won't have access to federal loans if they're going to CPCC.
And why is, on the surface, it seems like crazy, I guess, if you don't know about what's going on, why a community college would get out of a program like this. So what's their reasoning?
Well, and first, federal, you know, the federal loans are good because they're lower rate loans. And, you know, many of the students at CPCC, they take out these loans, but they also get what are called Pell Grants, which is a grant you don't have to pay back. And that's federal money as well. So there's a provision that if you are a college offering these federal direct loans, as they call them, that if your default rates get anywhere above 30% over 3 years, that there will be sanctions in place. And one of those sanctions is that you would lose Pell Grants. So the college would no longer be able to disburse Pell Grants to students.
So the school and its students are penalized for the default rate of other students.
Exactly. So you have a lot of community colleges thinking this through, especially, you know, as times were tough a few years ago, default rates were increasing. They thought, okay, we need to get out of this. In CPCC's case, they've actually only been offering this for a couple years because there was a state mandate that they had to do that, and then that changed. So now in North Carolina, you see a bunch of community colleges backing out of this program. There's only you know, something like 24 out of 58 community colleges in the state who are now offering this.
Well, what are the default rates?
Well, see, and that's the thing. That's part of the argument for I was speaking at people over at the Institute for College Access and Success. And, you know, they very much are in favor of keeping these federal direct loans at schools. And they're saying a lot of the schools, the community colleges in particular, who are backing out, you know, don't know what their default rate is. In North Carolina's case, they don't know what their default rate is because they've only been doing it for 2 years. So this is a 3-year thing. And so they are still waiting to hear what their default rate is.
I guess I assume that they are worried that it's pretty high or they wouldn't be doing
but
this.
Yeah, I mean, but yes, they are worried that it's high. And that's why they decided to back out. But they don't have the data on that right now.
Now, is the default rate usually it is higher for community colleges in general than it is for traditional four-year schools?
Yeah, it is. It is because, you know, community college students, often they're on a tighter income. Often they're cycling in and out of school. You know, they may have dependents as well, you know, kids they're supporting. So, yeah, it does tend to be higher.
And are they more likely to be part-time as well?
Yeah, and they're more likely to be part-time. So, you know, it's all those factors. But, you know, you see a lot of community colleges backing away from this. I mean, a huge amount. Most community college students do get Pell Grants. So they're saying, hey, you know, we back out of this. We're worried about, you know, that Pell Grant funding coming through. Now, another interesting thing that the Institute for College Access was saying is that, you know, part of the parameters with the default rates are the borrowing rates. And community college has lower levels of borrowing rates when it comes to these loans. So that would be factored into the whole equation, and they would be less likely to be sanctioned in that case.
Is CPCC going pretty much on anecdotal information? If they've been in this for a few years and they don't know what their default rate is there's got to be some way they can find out. Yeah.
I mean, how do you know?
Yeah, you know, I wonder that too. I mean, they have – so this is another, you know, reason as far – or this is one of the expenses of the program. It costs them $300,000 each year to administer it. But they've also had to pay back $250,000 at least in one school year for these are students who didn't complete enough courses to register in the program, and so they had to pay that money back. But it's not an agreement between the student and CPCC. It's agreement between the student and the federal government. So, you know, CPCC doesn't you know, for example, they can't screen their applicants. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that in this case, you know, it's that data they rely on the federal government for.
And the federal government, I guess, is slow in getting that information to them.
Well, you know, they calculate it over every 3 years. Okay. So there isn't a real impetus for the federal government to do it on a yearly basis.
Okay, interesting. We'll see how that develops. Another interesting story is reported by one of our favorite reporters, not with WFAE, but the Charlotte Observer, Ann Doss Helms. She had an interesting piece this week about charter schools, which is certainly something you've reported on a lot, Lisa. And it was basically they are public schools. We all know that. But the Department of Public Instruction has determined that charter schools don't have to reveal the salaries of their other staff, which because they are technically employed by a nonprofit private board.
And there's a lot of disagreement out there.
That's
Ann's,
just crazy.
Ann's article
that
quotes,
is insane.
Wait, Greg, how do you feel about it?
It's insane. They're public, and it seems like a lot of charter school people would agree with me too, or would agree.
Yeah,
with this.
Yeah, Ann's article quoted several charter school folks who said, "Well, that seems like kind of an oversight."
But what's the reason? We don't even. What is the reason for this? I mean, they get $300 some million a year at charter schools, and they are funded by tax dollars, but we can't find out what they're paying their employees?
Well, the reason is that they're operated by private nonprofit boards is what the Department of Instruction has said. But when they agree to public money, they agree to open meetings and public records laws.
Yeah, I mean, this is really common, though. You see this a lot, and I don't know if this is still the case, but certainly it probably is still the case, but certainly for a very long time in New York, you know, one of the things that would happen is they would rely on authorities to administer programs, right? So one of the most famous was, you know, back when Robert Moses was the kind of the master city planner of New York. And he could basically do what he wanted and just wouldn't release any records because, hey, we're an authority. We are we operate sort of as a corporation, although, you know, underneath public funds. Now, I don't believe that authority. I mean, I think we can get here in North Carolina, we can get information from authorities. But it's that same sort of idea. It's pretty common to say, well, hey, listen, yes, public money, but private entity, and private entities are not subject to the same rules of disclosure that that public are.
You know, one of the arguments for making those salaries public that I thought was really interesting in Ann's article, she quoted Terry Stoops from the John Locke Foundation. He said, look, charters are set up as these labs for experimentation. And, you know, teacher pay is a huge issue now. And, you know, some schools are kind of, you know, trying to figure out a way to do this. And how do you replicate a teacher pay scale if you don't know what's going on there?
If you can't look at it.
So,
if it's an experiment, then that would seem to lend itself to, well, hey, you know, let's see how the experiment's doing. What is it that they're doing?
This will be a story that I'm sure WFAE and other media outlets will be following. Very interesting. All right, guys, the 10th edition of WFAE Talks.
Thanks. All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.